Hello and welcome to the Business of Sustainability podcast, the latest show in partnership with Future Plus and City AM. My name is Alex Smith and I'm joined by my co-host and fellow founder of Future Plus, Mike Penrose. I'm delighted to introduce our excellent guest for today's show, Andrew Wordsworth, Managing Partner at Sustainable Ventures. Andrew, thank you for joining us. Perhaps you can give us a quick intro into your background and what it is you're doing now.
Yeah, so I'm the co-founder and CEO of Sustainable Ventures. Sustainable Ventures is the Europe's largest ecosystem of clean climate tech ventures. And we've been going since 2011 and delivering on our vision of developing commercial solutions to the challenges of climate change and resource scarcity.
Amazing. In this episode, we're going to be exploring Sustainable Ventures' mission and objectives and what makes its ecosystem truly unique. Mike, I'll hand over to you for the first question.
And thank you very much for joining us. You've given a little bit of background there as to what Sustainable Ventures are, but one of the things, you know, and obviously we've worked with you in the past, but one of the things I think our listeners will be really interested in is the difference between that you feel you have to other VCs, private equity firms. We get an awful lot that talk about impact and sustainability. To be frank, not so many that actually do it. What makes Sustainable Ventures different?
I think the key thing is we're basically on the side of the entrepreneur. I'm sure other VC firms will say that, but very few of them actually demonstrate that. That stems from, I guess, my background and a lot of the people who work for the company. Their background is in they've been entrepreneurs themselves. So they've been on the other side of the pitching table and know how hard it is to actually build and grow a venture, particularly in the sector, which you know can be quite tricky.
And you know, you talk about sustainability in terms of sustainable ventures. What is that for you? When you're on the side of the entrepreneur and looking at sustainability, what does that mean to you?
So Sustainable Ventures, we basically have, we weight commercial and sustainable as two halves of the same, two halves of the equation. We don't believe you have to compromise one, like you have to compromise commercial returns to deliver increased sustainable impact. So very much we see that sustainability is as a key part of what defines what we do. It varies quite enormously. We're just about to publish our third impact report. And the methodology we use there has always been looking at how each of the ventures impacts the 17 sustainable development goals set by the United Nations. So whilst climate impact is obviously a major one, we also see people looking at sort of tackling fuel poverty, looking at sort of deplasticizing the oceans and things like that. So there's a whole range of different things that you know, sustainability actually captures that's more than just carbon.
I think that's fascinating because Alex and I talk a lot about, you know, you get a certain sort of carbon myopia, so to speak. Whenever you talk about sustainability, people just look at carbon. And there's so much of a balance we find between carbon sequestration, but also then the environment and biodiversity. But fuel poverty, as you said, if you have a workforce and they're not being paid at least a living wage, how can you expect them to engage with your mission to decarbonize and all of these things? And finding that perfect balance, we agree with you on the UN Sustainable Development Goals, is often quite tricky because people are bombarded with, especially as an entrepreneur. So when you say you're on the side of the entrepreneur, what sort of help are you giving them in order to start balancing this out?
Yeah, so basically, Sustainable Ventures, its purpose is all about accelerating companies in the sector, which use basically from beer mat through to exit. And everything we do is designed to help companies, individuals and entrepreneurs and companies achieve that. So that could be, we've got a pre-seed investment fund, we're looking to raise sort of more funds in that area, we can invest more. We're looking to expand the workspaces so we can provide affordable workspace to companies in that sector. We can build those kind of communities and create that kind of peer-to-peer support as well. And we're also looking to expand the programmes, which are currently quite geographically limited to London. We work with the Greater London Authority and Lambeth Council. And we've helped over 300 companies and provided free consultancy support through that sort of public support. But that's very much limited to the geographical area. So that's why we're looking at Manchester and Glasgow and places like that. So wherever you've got a climate tech idea, we need to be in a position where we can help you. And we can channel that support towards you.
We've been having that conversation a lot recently. Yeah. And we are London-based as well. We are down the road from you. In Southwark, but I live in Hampshire, so I'm 2 hours south of that. But the amount of times that I've gone to events outside of London, and people are we just want more. We want knowledge, we want people, we want the facilities, the knowledge, the tech, the networking outside of London. And this, it does seem to be this huge sort of groundswell at the moment. And I know that the government have been trying to do it with their levelling up for a little while. I'm sure that's a whole other podcast and a whole other subject that we could go into. But, you know, are you finding that you are going there and, you know, build it and they will come? Or is it already there and it's just waiting for people to, you know, for the opportunity?
So certainly in Manchester, which is going to be our initial site, that will be open in October this year. We've already got a team there that are engaging with local climate tech businesses. There are about 600 climate tech businesses that are based in and around the Greater Manchester area. That's the biggest concentration outside London. And we're getting quite a warm reception. And people saying, this is fantastic, because I really want to be in a building where everybody is tackling climate change. And you get that strong sense of community, because if you go to County Hall, then everybody there, you don't get in the building if you're not tackling climate change. And that sort of singular sense of and shared sense of purpose, I think, brings people together in a real community. And one thing we've found sort of post-pandemic, obviously people have home, they have their office, and then there's the sort of the other place they go, the sort of third place you get on the pub or whatever. And actually, I'm not saying we can combine that second and third place. You create, you know, work needs to be a place where people are coming once or twice a week, and they're coming there because they want to have something. It needs to be more than just an office and a desk. And therefore, by combining things where you go to the cafe or you go to the bar in the evening in the workspace, and the person you sit next to will be tackling the same problem as you. And that creates an immense form of community you'd normally typically only get in a kind of village environment or whatever. So what we're trying to do is, you know, that's the real power. And that's why we have a workspace, but we're not, you know, we're more than just a workspace. It's where you're providing support to those companies. So of the companies we work with, between 80, only 15% of them have failed within 3 years. So we think the support we provide is as important as the actual community we build as well. So that's a sort of, it's a massive competitive advantage for if you're in the climate tech space, the resources we can bring, the investment we can bring, that's really what we're trying to achieve with replicating what we've got in County Hall and SE1 into these other places.
I think it's a fascinating stat as well, because I might have got it wrong, but normally the stats are somewhere upwards of 80% failing, you know, within a reasonable time period. And do you attribute that very much? Because we find that bringing people together, even in our office, is as much about overhearing conversations, providing, you know, creating a debate, creating a conversation that generates thought leadership. Is that some of the things you hear every day when you're in that area?
Yeah, I think so. And also, there are there's peer-to-peer networks sort of spontaneously spring up. So, for example, all the marketing people will get together, and you get people with sort of more mature scale-up companies who can actually afford a marketing manager, mm-hmm. can provide coaching to the CEO who can't afford a marketing manager and therefore is the marketing manager itself. So you're getting those kind of functional things, even though somebody maybe in Future Energy talking to somebody who's developing a building tech or a food tech company. But those functional skills are ones that can be really shared. That's not something we necessarily formally organise, but you get that sort of thing, and so because you've got a shared sense of purpose.
There's a great book, which I now can't remember the name of, that attributed a lot of the growth of Silicon Valley and the tech that came out of it by people who would meet from different offices in the same coffee shop. And it wouldn't necessarily even be a conversation. It would be overheard snippets of conversation that they would take. And it was that layering of ideas of ideas of ideas. And so, and it wasn't stealing, or it was genuine, just, you know, groups of people who with a passion towards a subject that wanted to talk about it. And that is what allowed that sort of huge growth. And I think being able to have those things in London and outside is vital. Yeah. I've got some, sorry.
As I say, so I'm just giving a good example. One of my favourite examples of that is our second workspace. And one of our biggest tenants there was Winnow, mm-hmm. who basically tackled food waste. And one of their lead customers was IKEA. And they came in to visit them. And while they were sort of wandering up and down the space, they came across Cheeky Panda, which is bamboo toilet rolls. And subsequently, IKEA became one of Cheeky Panda's biggest clients themselves. And we didn't, you know, so you didn't plan that and have a sort of, you know, meet the buyer type of thing. But it's just simply by wandering around that it's that kind of, that sort of sheer fortune in some ways. But actually, we can create that kind of look for the tenants we work with.
Absolutely. And I've got a few figures here about what, you know, in your ecosystem. You've got more than 500 startups in your direct ecosystem, 5,500 plus jobs created or maintained, and $1 billion total equity funds raised, and a diversity index of 85%, which is one, a mouthful, but also some really impressive stats of what you're doing. I mean, you've mentioned sort of Winnow and Cheeky Panda, which we know very well, and actually have recommended Winnow into quite a few of our clients over the last couple of years as a really interesting piece of tech for them to help with food waste. But have you got any other sort of success stories from that ecosystem? Obviously, so many are doing and not failing, but which means that they're clearly doing very well.
Yeah, I mean, Winnow's a great example of a success story from us, because they actually outgrew us. So they were, I think there were about 30 people when they were down in Bankside. Mm-hmm. And now I think they're, I don't know, they're probably 80, 100 people, maybe more than that. And so in some ways we have a sort of a membership model, a landlord type model. And for us, success is when people outgrow us and leave the building, which sounds commercially kind of a shock, but actually that shows they're delivering far, far, far more impact. So I think Winnow's a great example of that sort of those kind of success stories. Outside the workspace, in looking at our investment portfolio, so Rovco, which is basically they have a sort of underwater drones and they do offshore wind farm sort of foundation inspections. That was the first investment we made, and from a commercial point of view, the value of that company's grown by somewhere between 80 and 100 fold over the value we went in at. We invested at six, seven years ago. So we haven't exited yet, but we've got our fingers crossed that could be quite a big win all around in terms of the value delivered to those initial investors.
But also, it sounds like a great payday off a great project, which I guess is the point. Yeah. But obviously, because we work a lot with businesses individually, but we also work a lot with finance and with financiers. So we get a lot of, especially startup businesses, coming to us and saying, you know, what do I need to do? What do I need to demonstrate to get capital? What do the VCs you work with look for? So if a company's approaching you, what do you expect to see in that company?
Well, I think it echoes back to what's different about us compared to a VC. No matter what stage you're at, particularly on, say, Better Futures, which is the program we deliver with the Greater London Authority, we get companies that are literally sometimes just being formed at that point. And rather than saying, no, come back when you've done X, Y, and Z, we work with them to say, let's work out a pathway and let's provide the support, whatever support you need. And we obviously do quite a lot of investment readiness. We'll help people prepare pitch packs. We've got an in-house design agency that can help people with that. But also, we'll look at team building, and we'll look at, which is vitally important. It's often overlooked, particularly for single founders. Mm-hmm. And also sort of the kind of value proposition. So we can help them over that initial period. And then if they get to a certain stage, we've then got the next stage, which they'll move into our investment fund, which can then provide investment to them. Or we've co-invested with about 200 other investors in the space, which is probably more than any other organisation. And therefore, we've got quite a good sort of black book of people we can point them in the right direction if we're not the appropriate stage for them. So it's that journey, and sort of our job is to sort of hand them on and refer them to people. And that's not just investors. That we take the same attitude towards other services. Where as they mature and they grow up, they need other sort of services, whether it's impact assessment such as yourselves. We can basically signpost them in the right direction.
That support package for startups and for founders, I think particularly single founders, you're saying, is so vitally important. We often talk about the benefit of having two of us, that there's always somebody to sort of throw those ideas or pick up the pen and go, oh hell, what do we do here? But actually having that wider support is incredibly important. And I think, obviously with some of the work that we're going to be doing with, that Future Plus is going to be doing with Sustainable Ventures, about supporting, as you say, a lot of them are very mature on their climate and their the climate tech, and that's their entire focus. But being able to support across the wider social, economic, diversity and inclusion and help with those foundations and building blocks for what is a resilient business in the future, as well as a climate tech savvy, is something I think we're really looking forward to as we work with those startups.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other point there is, if you're a single founder, you can't be diverse, and all the evidence points to diverse companies outperform. So 65% of our investment portfolio have a female or a minority co-founder. And that's we think that's another strong factor in terms of why we get such as our investment portfolio outperforms the general market. Because they've got people, not only because, as you've probably found, you've got people to bounce ideas off and that kind of that resilience. But that's the other thing is you get that sort of different viewpoint and different point of view. Whereas if you're a single founder, you kind of come with you're white male. this is how you do things.
I think there's also 60-odd% that really bucks the trend, because the stats we often use is 2% of funding goes to all female teams, and about another 8%, you said, isn't it, goes to mixed gender teams. So if you're up there, and this is something that we're finding more and more as well. It's a great bit of work we did at the very formation of Future Plus, and we got Matthew Saeed in, who did Black Box Thinking and Rebel Ideas, and looking at that concept of, I think people misunderstand the concept of what diversity brings. They think it's a tick box exercise rather than diversity of thought. It's harder to come to, but when you come to a solution, when you've got diversity of thought, it's invariably better, because you've encompassed everything. Richard Branson does some great stuff with his Made by Dyslexia charity that he supports, where he shows that some disproportionate number, I think it's upwards of 40% of all self-made millionaires, are dyslexic or show dyslexic traits, because when the whole world thinks vertically, it's a competitive advantage to think laterally. When you're talking about impact, which you mentioned earlier, and be that with diversity or others, what is it that you consider impact? Because it's mentioned a lot, rarely done. Why do sustainable ventures take impact so seriously?
A couple of things. One, we sort of talked about carbon versus the other wider impacts. And clearly, when I look at my personal beliefs, I've got two young children. They're now 20 and 18, so they're not young. But when we started, they were obviously a little bit young. And obviously, it's a bit of a cliche. It's going to be their world that we're handing on. Mm-hmm. And I think, it does make, putting commercial and sustainability as equals really is, and that translates to, I'm very pleased personally that I'm doing something good for the world. It's like 35% of the technology we need to move to a net zero future haven't been invented yet.
Yeah.
And therefore, we feel like we're plugging that 35% through the work we do every day. And that translates down in the culture in terms of the people in the team who actually do all the amazing work and all the heavy lifting. They're all very driven by the same thing. So again, you get that culture, and it brings the culture of the company together. It means we can expand. We'll probably be with 40 people now. We'll be 80 by the end of the year. Making sure we're recruiting people who are also equally driven by delivering impact and see that as actually the purpose of why they're turning up to work. And that really helps. And equally, we also talk about jobs, which again might not necessarily be seen as impact, but actually in terms of delivering economic growth, particularly given there are a few politicians who are having a few waivers about net zero, realizing that you're creating jobs and this is generating economic wealth for the company is something that equally is vitally important to do that. So I say it's quite a complicated thing in terms of what do you mean by impact, and it's great because we work with so many different companies, each of them are tackling things in different ways. I think it's a great thing, because actually if a company's not delivering impact, we can say we're not going to work with you. Mm-hmm. It means we can work with people we like who share the same objective as us, and that's half the battle.
I think that's why we include economic as one of our indicators. You're quite right. I think it's possibly the most overlooked. People talk directly about diversity and inclusion or about climate impact, But, you know, we often joke that, you know, however good a business is, if it's out of business in 3 years because it's not looking at job creation, growth, the sort of scale, the profitability, then the idea can be brilliant, but it isn't going to last. So I think economic sustainability, as you talk about there, is as much a part of sustainability as every other part. Yeah.
You know, we were having a conversation around like what is impact. We were having a conversation the other day around the line was used by an economist about having mission outcomes, and they use free school meals as an example. And if your mission is to have a free school meal, you can have a really cheap free school meal. But if it's to have a local, sustainable, nutritious free school meal, it changes what the impact and the outcome is, and what needs to go in as the inputs at the very beginning. And I think having that wider view of what is it that we're trying to get to a healthier, more secure, more resilient, more employed workforce that are happier, healthier, and et cetera, it makes it much easier for business to go, now I get it. It's all of these things that we need to be moving forward between. And then it creates that community, because not necessarily one business can do all of those things. It's about that collaboration. It feels like it can be complex, but actually it becomes quite organic and quite natural when you're in environments like the workspaces at Sustainable Ventures.
Yeah, I think I was down at the Lambeth Strategic Partnership, which is their organisation of all the big businesses in the borough. I was looking around going, we're a scrappy startup, so what are we doing here? But seeing the range of their objectives. Obviously, they've got the transition to a net zero economy. It's one of them, but also, you know, they've got huge concerns about how they deliver for young people living in the borough. So that's why we talk about jobs and say, actually, you know, if we can be an inspiration to those people locally to see you can be a green entrepreneur, you know, you can earn a living, you can generate wealth for yourself, as well as tackling something that is dear to, you know, particularly young people, is really key to what they're all about. But it's where how we can, by creating a flagship workspace in their borough, how can we best use and how do we tick many of those different boxes without compromising on anything else? So I think it's those interconnections. That's the kind of the you know, that's the kind of free lunch, you know. So if you take a company like AirX, for example, a smart air brick, they're putting in air bricks. It saves, you know, up to 25% of a household's energy bill. So that's great. It's reducing carbon, it's reducing energy, but it's also saving the occupiers money and maybe lifts them out of fuel poverty. Yeah. So. And they're not compromising. The more bricks they put in, the more carbon they save, the more people they take out of fuel poverty. And that's they're not trading one off against the other. So I think those are the sorts of, some of the challenges is how do you actually get those sort of free lunches?
Yeah. What is it that you want to get to?
I think not just how you get the free lunches, but you know, one of the things that we find the light bulb goes off quite often in companies is the value it brings them if they look at this. And we often point back to the fact, and you know, Alex mentioned you're going up to Manchester, but you know, up there, arguably, I always argue, is the home of the first ever impact-focused organisations. When you look at the Lever Brothers, when you look at the Roundtree Villages, you know, I'd love to say that it was entirely altruistic, where they built towns for their workers and etc. But it was sort of realisation that, you know, agrarian workers that drop dead at 30 from tuberculosis aren't particularly productive in the industrial era. So by putting them in houses, providing them with healthcare and education for their kids, they got much more productive workers and consequently sort of dominated the world industrially. So I think it's a really interesting model, and especially ironic going back up to Manchester to build an understanding of how impact can actually have a really positive outcome for the investor as well as for the company.
Well, that's definitely where, we're a profitable company, and we're using those profits to reinvest into growth. And because we're a profitable company, we attracted investment from Barclays Sustainable Impact Capital. Yeah. Ultimately, it's a balance sheet fund. They're a VC. But again, it's, you know, we're working very closely with their wider organisation, and they've kind of got that. I think it was 2 months ago they announced they weren't going to invest into fossil fuels anymore. I think partly because they realise it's a declining industry, and therefore they should be putting their money into like climate tech, because that's where the future profits are going to be. But yeah, so say probably a similar example of their, I'm not saying they're entirely altruistic and saying we're going to do this because we believe in the, they individually they do, but their shareholders perhaps, you know, have been a bit skeptical in the past.
Well, it's Warren Buffett, isn't it? Arguably the world's most successful investor, who says pick a product that's going to is going to exist in 50 years and take a long position on it.
Yeah.
So it's and I think, you know, I left the not-for-profit sector because I got a little, you know, upset with almost it became a self-sustaining industry, whereas charity should be patching the gaps that society hasn't figured out to patch for itself yet. But the only way we really build a sustainable business, I think, is through making it profitable, making people benefit from it, making it create jobs, and again, ultimately having an outcome that benefits people.
Yeah. I'd say the thing I mentioned about Barclays, so Sustainable Impact Capital have now invested $134 million in 21 climate tech companies. So that, you know, they are putting their money where their mouth is, balance sheet fund. Yeah. So it's very easy for people to sort of have a greenwash, we're moving towards climate tech, but actually it's when the money starts flowing, and that, again, it's really, really great to see. And I say, it's you know, in terms of as an investor, I think we are completely aligned with what they want to achieve in the sector and what we want to achieve in the sector. We're just a little bit, we're sort of the nursery slopes, if you like, and then we can hand over to the, you know, where the big money comes in.
Right. But without those nursery slopes, you can't get any further, and it's such an important part of the ecosystem. And I suppose on that, you must meet founders and a range of founders as you've sort of worked through sustainable ventures and your background. Is there a piece of advice that you give to those that are thinking of coming into climate tech, that are thinking of starting a company, that think that, you know, what piece of advice would you give them?
I think the thing, thinking about climate tech, if you really want to make an impact, don't come up with a carbon calculator. We see a lot of people, you know, maybe had a couple of too many glasses of wine at a dinner party, go, I know, we can do, I'll map everybody's carbon footprint. There's loads of those. If you really want to do, go down to Imperial or the University of Manchester and find a smart engineer, mm-hmm. and say, right, you know, I can bring my commercial skills, and you've invented a widget, and those widgets are the thing that's really going to change. Basically, sort of, the industry is moving much more towards deep tech, and moving away from, it used to be like people came in and were just like, oh, we'll just do software, and software will save the world. It won't.
Yeah.
You know, but when we move to a net zero economy, you know, physical things are going to happen. We have to use less energy. We're going to have to use new materials. And the investment is starting to move in that direction. And we're changing our investment focus much more towards that kind of hardware, deep tech side of things. So that would be my advice, is, you know, if you, yeah, just, you know, go and find a co-founder with complementary skills to you. And the same, we'll go into university and say, right, you've fantastic, you've invented this widget, this better mousetrap. Go and find, you know, somebody with an MBA, or, you know, who's passionate and has the commercial skills, and then blend those together, and that's where you get this kind of diverse teams outperform, and sort of diverse, like, personalities and skill sets, and that's why we see, you know, that's why the 65% stat is there, because we look at that and see, you know, people who can work with other people who aren't just like them. So that's why I say, yeah, it's difficult to put your nose, but I think in terms of entrepreneurs, you know, yeah, go sell yourself to somebody else. If you can't sell yourself to somebody else as a co-founder, then you're not going to be able to sell what you want to do to somebody, to a corporate or to an investor.
That's great. Cambridge is a great example. If you go around coast, you'll know, if you go around the town of Cambridge now, the volume of biotech, high-tech industries, which are effectively people such as yourselves and other investors going and going, there's a load of really smart people there who have really good ideas, and that's produced the Arm Holdings of this world, you know, and all of the other tech companies around there is, poach the really smart people. I think that's all we've got time for today, but a huge thank you, Andrew, for joining us. And if you'd like to join the conversation, please leave a comment or questions in the comments and email us at info@future-plus.co.uk. And please remember to hit the subscribe button for future episodes. And if you'd like to find out more about Future Plus or sustainable ventures, please look in the description. And thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you for having me along.